Hey y'all, I'm Michelle Guest, a proud supporter and member of the ACNC True Crime Posse from Fort Worth, Texas. Everyone knows Fort Worth is the home of Texas Christian University, Billy Bob's, the world famous Dockyards, and Hill's Half Acre. But we in Panther City are proud as peacocks to be the home of all crime, no cattle. So kick back with a cold sweet tea, because it's time for ACNC, All Crime, No Cattle. Take it away, Aaron and Shay.
Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I'm Aaron.
And I am Shay.
And that was Michelle Guest, who introduced the show for us this week. That's going to be a new feature for all of our Texas Rangers. We're going to have them do a little intro in one of the segments of our show. Michelle Guest was the one who got to us first, and so that's why she's doing it first.
That's right. That's the perks of getting on top of it. The early ranger gets to the criminal.
That's right. And if you would like to do it, just head on over to patreon.com/allcrimenocattle. All right. Well, Shay has a really great episode for us today. But before we begin, we have another update for you all pertaining to the Texas Seven and the few remaining men who are still on death row for the murder of Officer Aubrey Hawkins back in 2000. On Thursday, March 28th, Patrick Murphy was set to be executed, but was offered a temporary stay. Now, his appeals have focused mainly on Texas's law of parties, which states that an individual can be held criminally responsible for the actions of another in their group. This is how all of the Texas Seven were tried on capital murder charges, even though not all of them actively participated in Officer Hawkins' murder. Murphy, if we remember all the way back to our episodes on the Texas Seven, was the lookout during the robbery that led to Officer Hawkins' death, and therefore wasn't even in the immediate area when Hawkins was murdered. So that's kind of one issue that we have going on with this execution appeal. And in fact, many of the Texas Seven's appeals argued that the law of parties is unconstitutional.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
However, Murphy's stay of execution was granted due to another appeal from Murphy's defense team, which claimed his religious rights were being trampled upon. You see, all death row prisoners are supposed to be granted religious advisors to attend to them inside the execution chamber. So this is a situation where a chaplain or a spiritual advisor can come inside the execution chamber, pray over them, be with them. Usually they put their hands on their leg or their arm, some part of their body, and are with them during the execution process, both before and during the execution.
Everybody's supposed to get that.
Yes. And these people, because they are active members inside the execution chamber, they have to be employed by the state of Texas. Well, Patrick Murphy, who has converted to Buddhism during his stay on death row, he requested a Buddhist spiritual advisor to be allowed in during his execution. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice, however, declined the request, stating that they only employed Christian and Muslim advisors. So basically, you're like, you're SOL because we just don't happen to have any Buddhist advisors.
You can't just contract a Buddhist priest to come in for 1 hour. It doesn't seem like that big of a deal to me.
Well, it became a very big deal. Murphy's lawyers brought the issue all the way up to the Supreme Court, who ultimately agreed that Murphy's rights were being infringed. Justice Kavanaugh stated in his opinion that either all religious beliefs of death row prisoners should be respected and treated the same, or none should be. So basically, they're saying it's an all or nothing situation. You can't pick and choose which religions you're going to accommodate.
I agree with that.
Yeah. He wrote, quote, "As this court has repeatedly held, governmental discrimination against religion, in particular discrimination against religious persons, religious organizations, and religious speech, violates the Constitution." The Supreme Court ordered that Murphy's execution be postponed until the TDCJ found a Buddhist advisor to attend to the execution or until the religious issue was resolved. Well, on April 3rd, it was resolved. The TDCJ announced that, effective immediately, prisoners who will be executed in Texas will no longer be granted religious advisors or chaplains to attend to them in the execution chamber during their executions. And this is a direct result of Murphy's appeals.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is really big news as far as the Texas justice system goes and Texas death row. And it'll be interesting to see how this decision will play out, if this is just sort of another way to discriminate against religious persons, or, you know, if this is going to be another kind of issue that people are going to broach or appeal against or whatever. It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. For now, Patrick Murphy's execution date will once again be rescheduled. He was originally serving a 50-year sentence for robbery and aggravated sexual assault with a deadly weapon before the prison escape that ended with Officer Aubrey Hawkins' murder. As always, we will continue to keep you apprised of any news about this and other cases we've covered. In the meantime, if you haven't already, be sure to check out our episodes on the Texas Seven, which were episodes 17 and 18 of this podcast.
Yeah, that's right. And thank you so much for that update, Aaron.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you. A couple people made sure to send those news stories on over to us. So thank you to those people who sent those in as well.
Definitely. That's the ACNC posse doing their work. All right. With that all out of the way, are we ready to move on to the episode today?
I'm ready.
All right. For this episode, I've been cooking up something that I think you're going to find fascinating. First off, we need to thank one of our Texas Rangers, and that's Drew Margerison, for sponsoring and helping to produce this series. Thank you, as always, to your sponsorship and providing to the show, Texas Rangers. We can't do it without you. I know we were recently in Corpus Christi for the Flatline murder case, but we need to head right back there once more as we dive into one of the wildest cases I have ever heard of from the 1980s. This is a case that appears simple on the surface, but years later we are now learning this is a cautionary tale for local law enforcement, as well as the Texas legal system. The details involve everything from a vicious murder, terrible luck, doppelgangers, and even the horrifying question of, did we actually catch the killer? Over the next two episodes, we will discuss all of this and more, so sit back and strap in for episode 49, The Tale of Two Tocoyos, part 1. Let's hit up some sources real fast. First off, we used an article from the Austin Chronicle written by Jordan Smith in 2012. We also used an article from The Guardian written by Ed Pilkington in 2012. I used an article from the Chicago Tribune written by Stephen Mills and Maurice Posley back in 2006. And our main source for this episode is a book written by a law professor named James Liebman that was first published in 2014. I'm not going to say the name because it kind of gives too much away for our episode, but I will provide the Kindle Unlimited link, where you can go and read this big book. I also used some witness interviews from ABC News and PBS NewsHour, and those were from a broadcast that aired back in 2013 and 2012. All right, so let's get into the case, Aaron. Just over a month before St. Patrick's Day, on February 4th, 1983, good fortune seemed to already be in the air. Wanda Jean Vargas Lopez, a 24-year-old single mother, had told her family she had gotten some good news, and she wanted to share it. Wanda refused to spill the details of the news, though, because she wanted to celebrate that Friday night after she got off of her shift at work by taking her brother, Richard Vargas, out for drinks. She then headed out for her 3 to 10 p.m. shift that Friday at the local Sigmore Shamrock gas station in southwest Corpus Christi. She left her 5-year-old daughter in the care of her two parents. Wanda typically worked these evening shifts alone, and although she had only worked there a few months, she was quickly promoted to an assistant manager. The Sigmore Shamrock gas station was far from the safest place to work an evening shift in Corpus Christi. The gas station itself was small and sat in a high-crime area in the town's southern district off of South Padre Island Drive and the Crosstown Expressway. Inside, security was minimal, if any. Wanda worked the register and the pumps from behind a small counter with one of those flip-up countertops. No glass barrier, sliding security drawer, or shelves of merchandise blocked the access to the cashier. There were also no security cameras installed. After all, it was 1983 and the video security systems were not very affordable for small businesses until the 1990s. Nowadays, all of these small little security features have become commonplace in late-night filling stations or convenience stores in bad neighborhoods. Odds are, if you've been to one of these lately, you've overlooked these little features. Besides the lack of security, another element of danger for Wanda came in the form of rowdy patrons of a rough gentleman's club across the street called Wolfie's. This particular club catered to bikers, hellraisers, and bar fighters on a regular basis, many of which would hit up Sigmore Shamrock as they left the club looking for snacks, beer, or cigarettes. Wanda took her job very seriously and was willing to do whatever it took to make ends meet for her young daughter. Wanda dropped out of high school, got married, and had kids at a young age. A few months after her daughter was born, her husband pulled the old go out for cigarettes and never come back trick. Wanda never heard from him again. She didn't like the hours or the neighborhood, but she needed the paycheck. She also had high hopes of moving to the day shift soon or getting a place in a nicer neighborhood. Perhaps this was the good news she was planning on sharing. Her father would often drive up to the gas station at night and keep watch until Wanda finished her shift. A police officer named Robert Mayorga knew Wanda, and they had gone out a few times. As a sort of courtesy, he would drive by the Sigmore Shamrock on a late weekend night and make sure she was doing okay. According to James Liebman's interviews with Robert Mayorga, they even developed a set of hand signals they could use with each other so that he could stay outside in his squad car and kind of see if she was all right. Neither Robert or her father were watching over Wanda that Friday night, however, and Wanda's good fortune was unknowingly about to run out. Around 8:10 p.m. on Friday, February 4th, 1983, a frantic 911 call came into the Corpus Christi Police Dispatch. Quote, "Can you have an officer come to 2602 South Padre Island Drive? I have a suspect with a knife inside the store. He's Mexican. He's standing right here at the counter." Then she whispered, "Can't talk." End quote. The voice asking the dispatcher for aid on the call was that of Wanda Lopez. This was not the first time that night that Wanda had spoken with a Corpus Christi dispatcher, though. Earlier that night, Wanda had been approached by a concerned customer saying that there was a man outside acting strange and wielding a knife.
Do we know if this was the same man?
Yes, it's the same guy, and you're about to find that out. Wanda decided to call the police and report this man. To her surprise, they told her they unfortunately wouldn't be able to do anything unless the man came inside and began threatening people. Well, he did come into the Shamrock gas station a few minutes later, and now Wanda was back on the line with another dispatcher as he stood there with his knife out. The dispatcher tried to ask Wanda questions, but she was more focused on the situation at hand. You hear Wanda responding to what investigators now assume was the strange man. Quote, "Okay. This? 85. I don't know. Not yet. Por qué?" End quote. She continued to try and answer the man's questions, but eventually the situation escalated, and you can hear Wanda's voice appear to sound desperate. Quote, "You want it? I'll give it to you. I'm not going to do anything to you. No, please," end quote. And then Wanda screamed. Next, the only sounds that came were a muffled 6 seconds of audio that sounded like a struggle, then the sound of the phone falling from the counter to the floor. A few moments later, Wanda moaned, and shortly thereafter, someone hung up the phone. Most likely, this was Wanda's attacker. Just a handful of seconds earlier, Kevin Baker pulled up to the Sigmore gas station in his 67 Mercury Cougar. He quickly got out and he started trying to pump a few bucks of gas into his collectible muscle car. As it turned out, Kevin was in a hurry that night. He had just left his work, and he had plans to head out for some Friday night dancing with his wife. The only problem was, he had been forced to stay an hour late at work, and he knew his wife wasn't going to be happy with him. Kevin reportedly heard a bang from inside the gas station, like the sound of someone smacking the window. Kevin later told police that he thought the sound was likely the clerk hitting their hand on the front window next to the counter, likely wanting him to pay inside and come in before he started pumping his gas. He stubbornly tried to pump the gas anyhow, and ignored this noise. But when no gas came out, he finally looked up towards the spot where the clerk should have been, at the window, and that's where he saw a man with dark hair and a dark complexion behind the counter wrestling with the female store clerk. After a few short seconds, he realized this was a real struggle. At first, he thought they may have just been messing around, but then he thought to himself, why is he behind the counter? He watched the man drag the clerk by the hair towards a door to what looked like a back room. Wanda was fighting back with everything she had. Kevin admitted to considering leaving, but he didn't. Instead, he headed for the front door of the store. As Kevin approached the door, he saw the man throw Wanda to the floor behind the counter. Next, Kevin saw the man stand up. The attacker noticed him. It was then that Kevin realized he was the only other person present at the Sigmore Shamrock. At that point, the man leapt over the counter and moved towards the front door. Kevin stood his ground near the entrance. The attacker walked out right up to Kevin, and he told him bluntly, quote, "Don't mess with me. I got a gun." Kevin was wary, even though the man had empty hands. He thought maybe he had a gun in his pocket or in his pants, so he didn't say anything. He just stared the man down. A few seconds later, the attacker sprinted off eastward. He turned left at the corner of the building and disappeared into the darkness behind the gas station. A few moments after the man sprinted away, another car pulled into the Shamrock. Kevin yelled to the driver, "Quick, find a phone. Call the police." This is about the time when Kevin noticed the store clerk. Wanda was staggering to the front door slowly. A long trail of blood dripped down her left side. Kevin grabbed her, and he helped her down onto the concrete by the entrance. Her left side was quickly becoming saturated with blood. Wanda kept telling Kevin, quote, "Help me. Help me." And she repeatedly tried to stand up. Kevin tried to stay calm and to keep Wanda lying down. Kevin had naval training and first aid, so he started looking for the wound, and he pulled off Wanda's sweater and discovered a cut in the fabric of her bra near her left breast. Blood was pouring from the hole. From the look of the wound, Kevin knew she didn't have much time. Wanda was losing too much blood. He ran into the store, he found a roll of auto wipes, and he ran back out to try and pack Wanda's wound. As he worked to save her life, police cars and ambulances began pulling into the parking lot and relieved Kevin of his work. He got up, walked over to the ice machine at the corner of the store, and watched alongside other bystanders who claimed to have information regarding the fleeing attacker. Paramedics quickly deduced the knife wound Wanda sustained was a cut to her artery in her chest, as well as puncturing her lung. They hooked her to a special machine for punctured wounds and began transferring her to a stretcher.
So she only had one stab wound to the chest?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And it was a stab wound, right? Not a bullet wound.
It is a stab wound, but I guess at this point, they didn't really know that much yet. They just really knew that she had a puncture wound.
Okay.
About a quarter past 8 p.m., a young boy from the neighborhood arrived on his bicycle to the Vargas' home. He yelled to the family that Wanda was hurt and to come to the gas station as soon as possible. Her brother Richard left immediately. He arrived on the scene as Wanda was being moved from the concrete onto a stretcher and then up into the ambulance. He tried to push his way through the police officers to get to his sister, but they held him back and told him he could see her at the hospital. Everyone Richard asked questions to about what went on either didn't know or wasn't willing to say. Everyone just kept telling him it was a tragedy. He then went to the windows of the storefront to look for clues as to what may have happened to Wanda. Inside, he didn't see detectives or forensic teams laying down evidence markers or dusting for prints. What Richard claims he saw, besides a huge bloody mess, was what looked like two people in street clothes, cleaning the bloody floors. They appeared to be working quickly. This struck Richard as really strange. Why didn't it look like it does on TV or the movies? Where were all the detectives and forensic technicians? Side note. I have not been able to corroborate Richard Vargas's claims about this cleaning crew actually cleaning up at this particular moment in the case.
Yeah, I was about to say that's awfully weird, especially if she was the only employee there. So it's not like it would be other employees. So who would these people be?
Well, we're going to introduce a couple of the store employees here in a second. But according to them, the cleanup didn't begin until later.
Okay. So already, immediately after this happens, we have multiple witnesses saying different things.
And that is going to be a theme of this episode.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, can we say a big praise to Kevin?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because that's incredible bravery to witness some kind of struggle going down between two strangers. And instead of running away and trying to contact authorities, he actually went inside that building to try to help. And that's really incredible.
Yeah.
Because he could have gotten hurt, too.
A lot of people wouldn't have done it. They would have gone with his first impulse, which is like, I got to get out of here. This isn't my problem.
Yeah.
Well, before Richard could investigate what was going on with these employees further, the ambulance pulled out of the parking lot and Richard realized he needed to get in his car and go to the hospital. Police were, in fact, all over the exterior of the scene at this time. They were holding the crowd back and taking statements. Some were interviewing Kevin Baker about what had happened. Kevin told the police the attacker appeared Hispanic with dark hair, and he was about 5'9". He thought he looked maybe 25, 28. He also said the man didn't look drunk, but rather cold and calculating, like he knew what he was doing. Police were also speaking with another handful of the witnesses who said they had seen a similar man. Two witnesses said they saw a man running northbound on Dodd Street, which was the street in between the Shamrock gas station and Wolfie's. Another couple said they also saw a similar man jogging east away from the gas station along the frontage road. Now, I'm going to provide an area map from the James Liebman book because it shows the area around the crime scene along with all the witness statements and their locations when they saw a person. So that way you'll kind of understand that these sightings and these reports that are coming in are coming from complete opposite directions.
Mm-hmm.
So again, multiple stories from multiple witnesses.
Yeah.
From this group of five people, police got varying reports on the attacker's description too. For instance, Kevin Baker described the man as older, scruffy, wearing dirty clothes like he was homeless. Other witnesses described the man as young, clean-shaven, and wearing nice clothes. Therefore, investigators had no other choice but to use a composite description, which was then broadcasted on a Be on the Lookout. This confusing Be on the Lookout reads as follows, quote, a Hispanic male, mid-20s to early 30s, 5'9", with flannel shirt, possibly a gray sweatshirt. It may possibly be a white t-shirt or long sleeves. He might be clean-shaven, medium, wavy, ear-length hair, maybe looking for a ride to Club Casino, end quote.
Okay, so they might as well have said, we don't know what he was wearing.
Yeah. A Hispanic male could have been the vague
basically,
description.
Of any age, yeah. Yeah.
You tell me, listeners, if you were one of the police out there looking for this guy, would you be able to keep all of that straight? Would you be able to keep the multiple different possible descriptions in your head as you're scanning the people driving around in your patrol car? I'm thinking you would see one person that had characteristics of one, but then characteristics of another, and be like, oh, wait, could that possibly be him? I guess I need to arrest him, or at least question him. Also consider that this is prime partying time in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood near a ton of bars and nightclubs. There are people out everywhere that could possibly fit this vague description.
Yeah, this was, what at this point, about 9 o'clock on a Friday night?
Yes.
It was about 8-something when Wanda was stabbed?
Yeah, and like when I was reading in this book about different witnesses and where they came from, they almost all came from a different nightclub. And like people are going in and out of these dance clubs and gentlemen clubs and all this stuff. It's confusing as all get out.
Yeah, it seems that way. Hey, ACNC listeners, if you love true crime and getting your dessert on, then you need to check out Serial Killer Suites from San Antonio, Texas. Serial Killer Suites specializes in ginormous gourmet rice cereal treats that are to die for, with incredible flavors like cookies and cream, hot chocolate, peanut butter cup, and unicorn swirl.
Oh my gosh, these things are so tasty. She sent us the peanut butter one, a Nutella surprise one, and a peppermint bark one. They were all delicious. Really good.
My favorite one was the peanut butter cup. It comes with a smooth, creamy, sumptuous peanut butter layer on top. And then when you get into it, there's a peanut butter cup right nestled in there.
Surprise.
We also love the fact that Serial Killer Suites donate 10% of their monthly sales to local area nonprofits like the Humane Society and Thrive Youth Center, and that they're a proud LGBT-owned business. Now, if you're interested in trying one of the Rice Krispie Beasts, head on over to the website serialkillersweets.com or give them a call at 210-753-2032. Once you place your order, they'll be ready to ship anywhere in the U.S. in just 1 to 2 days.
So do your taste buds a favor and check out Serial Killer Sweets to get your hands on some sinful treats to feed your inner demons. Check out all the deliciousness over at SerialKillerSweets.com, and that's cereal with a C, like the breakfast food.
I hate spending too much money on brand name clothing. You have to drive to the store, search through racks, only to pay too much for something you never even end up wearing. Well, I found a really great solution, and it's an online thrift shop called Swap.com. At Swap.com, you can easily sift through millions of clothes in seconds on their website or mobile app. Their easy-to-use filters help you find great, high-quality pieces in your favorite brand or size and have them shipped right to your door. I found some really cute and unique dresses on Swap.com that I'm really excited about, and I didn't even have to put on pants to do it. Swap.com has something for the whole family, including women's, men's, juniors, kids, baby, and maternity clothing. And what's really amazing is you can save up to 90% off retail prices on your favorite brands like Lululemon, Carter's, Nike, J.Crew, and Gap. And if something doesn't fit, well, they have hassle-free returns within 30 days. And we have a special offer for listeners of All Crime No Cattle. Just go to swap.com/cattle, and once there, you can sign up to get free shipping on your first purchase. It's a low-risk way to give online thrifting a try. Once again, that's swap.com/cattle for free shipping on your first purchase of high-quality thrifted items.
Well, one of the first officers on the scene was Ruben Riviera, and he remembered how the chaotic manhunt began for Wanda's attacker. He was part of a hodgepodge group of different law enforcement officers from several different agencies, such as the Wildlife Rangers, City Police, Sheriff Deputies, Highway Patrolmen, and even vice officers that were wearing plain clothes and driving around in an unmarked car. When I read that, I was thinking, that's the worst group to include in this, because how confusing is that when you're in a manhunt and there's an unmarked car and police officers in street clothes running around in the middle of the night? Either way, they began surrounding an area of several square blocks emanating from the scene, and then they began to collapse this circle inward towards the Sigmore Shamrock gas station, looking for someone who fit the composite description. As you can imagine, radio traffic was crazy during the next hour or so as the search went on. Several false identifications were made, several people were apprehended and held, but then released. Cars were stopped, and the people inside were checked. Lots of people ran because they had warrants or traffic tickets. Almost anyone out that night was treated as a suspect. This resulted in misinformation, confusion, radio chatter, and dead-end leads. At one point, the search team thought they had located the attacker fleeing on foot and were involved in a very intense, confusing foot chase that went through a neighborhood almost a mile away to the east of the scene. This person, whoever they were, ended up eluding the police. Meanwhile, at 8:39 p.m., a call came into dispatch from a neighborhood resident, Teresa Barrera. She lived just a street over from the Sigmore Shamrock on Easter Drive, and she claimed someone was hiding under her truck and then took off to the southeast.
Okay, that seems promising.
Yeah, why would you be hiding under a truck and then all of a sudden just get up and sprint off?
Yeah.
Well, Constable Ruben Riviera was the first man to the area to spot this particular person, and they were hiding under another truck, but a street over on Franklin Street, trying to hide in a puddle that was kind of underneath that truck.
Okay, that's odd.
Yeah, weird place to hide. Well, as he closed in on the suspect, Riviera noticed that he wasn't wearing a shirt, he wasn't wearing shoes or socks. He gave up easily and told the officers, quote, "Don't shoot me. You've got me." Riviera said the smell of alcohol on the man was overbearing. Officer Milet of the Corpus Christi Police was one of the assisting officers on this arrest. He knew the man as Carlos de Luna, a 20-year-old man who Milet had arrested for drunk and disorderly conduct just 2 weeks earlier over at the casino club. Does that ring a bell? It was in the Be on the Lookout. Someone was looking for a ride to the casino club.
Yeah, I was confused about how they got that particular information to be on the bolo.
One of the witnesses had an encounter with a man looking for a ride to the casino club who fit the description.
I see. Okay. And it's very mysterious that he's missing all these clothes, as if he got rid of evidence, if he had bloody clothing, you know, threw off everything he was wearing and then is now hiding underneath vehicles. Okay.
Right. Well, the arresting officers took Carlos de Luna back to the scene of the crime where Kevin Baker and the other witnesses were still waiting. So they cuff him, they throw him in the patrol car, and they drive back over. So the police then asked the witnesses if they could identify the man in the back of the patrol car as the attacker. At first, none of them wanted to face the man, and I don't blame them.
No. Yeah, of course.
Especially if you're Kevin, right? Like, you just had this really scary encounter with this guy. The last thing you want to do is go over and hang out next to him in a police car. But eventually, they all relented and they walked over to the patrol car where Carlos de Luna sat. One of the patrol officers shined a flashlight into his face. And after a few short minutes, the four witnesses and Kevin Baker agreed that Carlos de Luna was the man they had seen. Side note, Kevin Baker later told James Liebman in his book that they all took their time to ID the man. During this time, investigators grew anxious, and Kevin said after a few minutes of encouragement from the officers, questions, and some pressuring, they all made their final decision.
Okay, so what did he mean by encouragement and pressure? Like, they were encouraging them to positively identify this man?
That's what it seems like.
That does not seem great.
No. And this field identification process is known as a show-up identification. James Liebman and other people who investigate cases like this don't have high things to say about field identifications or show-up identifications.
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely eyewitness statements are very suspect to begin with, but that's a very incredible high-stakes, high-pressure situation, and it's not even a photo lineup. It's, hey, is this the guy standing right in front of you who just stabbed a woman?
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be him, right? He's missing his shirt. Look at him. Is that him? Isn't that the guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, leading questions and, like, easy ways you could pressure someone into an identification.
Absolutely, even if that's not your intention.
Right. Well, after this field identification process, Carlos de Luna was taken to the police station for processing and, later on, formal charges. He had $149 in his pocket that was all wadded up, a wallet with a couple of bucks in it, and some Winston cigarettes, and that was it.
Okay, so knife is not recovered.
Not at this moment. Back at the hospital, Richard reunited with his parents and Wanda's young daughter. There, they waited a short while before a doctor came out to deliver the tragic news that Wanda didn't make it. The damage and the internal bleeding to her artery and her lung were too severe.
Oh, that is so sad.
I know. They were obviously destroyed by this news. Richard said that the shock just washed over them. And they had to just regroup, and they grieved for a little while, and then eventually they got it all together, and they returned home. Sometime later, the Vargas's family finally heard more details about what happened that night, but they didn't hear it from investigators. They heard it from the news, the radio, and the newspapers. You see, the recording of the 911 call where Wanda pled for her life leaked to the media, and nobody told them.
Oh, God, can you imagine how awful that would be to hear your daughter's last words before she's murdered?
Well, that's exactly what happened, because the Vargases were sitting watching the evening news when all of a sudden they heard Wanda's voice.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Yeah, the first time it played, Wanda's mother and daughter were also in the room. Ugh. And over the following days, it played over and over in the news cycle. Richard said it haunted their family and did terrible psychological harm to Wanda's mother and her young daughter.
Sure, of course it would. That's unacceptable.
Yeah, it's pretty rough, man.
Man, I really wish. I know 911 calls are in public domain, etc., but I think that we need to be careful about how we present them to the public when there's family involved. My God.
Yeah, like, give a warning, or maybe wait a little bit. Like,
yeah.
Maybe there should be a time frame that you have to wait.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound like there was any reason to release them to the public anyway.
No, it was really just shock value.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not like his voice was captured, the attacker. So what was the point other than clickbait, you know,
yeah.
News bait?
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, how awful.
Well, back at the scene that Friday night, police photographer Joel Infante and Detective Olivia Escobedo were among the first to step into the Sigmore Shamrock and survey the scene. And this was about 9 p.m. Friday night. The gas station manager, Robert Stange, and his area supervisor, Pete Gonzalez, reportedly waited outside as they worked. Stange told James Lieberman in his book that they worked the scene really quickly. At one point, Detective Escobedo came out to Pete Gonzalez and inquired how much money he thought was missing from the till. Looking through the windows, Gonzalez told the detective it would be hard to tell with all the blood and the money everywhere. He hadn't done a full inventory. Later, Gonzalez did do the inventory and estimated $166 were missing. He reported his findings to the investigators. As Detective Escobedo worked inside the gas station, she drew an interior diagram of the crime scene. Infante followed closely by and snapped crime scene photos. The combination of both painted a horrific picture of what actually happened in the store in just a few short minutes. Blood. Lots of blood. There were footprints in it. There were handprints in it. Various types of blood spatter covered the ground behind the counter, from mistings and sprays to large pools and heavy droplets. A drag mark was made in it, where the attacker had tried to pull Wanda back into the back room. I will be sure to include the crime scene diagram in our episode pictures as well. Detective Escobedo documented and bagged what she believed was the murder weapon. It was a folding buck knife that was found laying near the cash register. Some other small items she found were a partially smoked Winston cigarette butt behind the counter and a stray new pack of Winstons on the counter. Perhaps this new pack was something the attacker had been attempting to buy as a sort of ruse before they struck. By 10 p.m., about an hour after they had entered the gas station, Detective Escobedo and the photographer Infante made their way out. As they walked past Gonzalez and Stange, Escobedo reportedly told them, "It's all yours." Both men were shocked. How could you work a scene for an obvious murder and maybe a robbery that quickly? Both men figured they must have gotten enough evidence and they had a suspect that pulled up earlier in a patrol car. Maybe it was that simple. Stange and a manager from another store got to work scrubbing the whole store down top to bottom less than 2 hours after the brutal murder of Wanda Lopez.
Wow, that seems awfully quick.
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing about Stange's report about what was going on inside the store was one detective and one dude taking pictures.
Yeah.
There was no fingerprint team or blood spatter team. It was just two people. So I found that really shocking.
Yeah.
Well, Stange told James Liebman about what he saw that night. Stange had a shockingly good memory and described details of the scene that could only be found in the crime scene photos, which Stange never saw. Needless to say,
wait, what?
He had a good enough memory to describe specific details that you could only know from seeing the crime scene photos, but he never saw them.
Well, how does that make sense?
Because he cleaned the inside of the store. It stuck with him that hard. He remembered everything.
Oh, okay.
It was shocking. Like, it imprinted on his brain.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, and needless to say, he said he still doesn't sleep well because of all this.
Gosh, and I'm surprised that there wasn't, I mean, that you wouldn't hire a, you know, a cleanup crew who does this kind of stuff. Ugh, I can't imagine doing it myself.
I wonder if they had those in 1983. I don't know. Investigators turned over the crime scene report once they were done and all the witness statements to the DA office. After looking over the evidence, they decided to move forward with a capital murder charge against Carlos de Luna. His trial was set for the following month. Clearly, they thought this was a slam dunk case. Later, the trial would be postponed due to a request by one of de Luna's court-appointed attorneys, Hector de Pinea. This was to allow for a period of discovery of new evidence, and that new evidence was from de Luna himself. He told his attorney that he had in fact been outside the gas station that night and had witnessed the attack through the windows. However, de Luna claimed he was innocent and not the man they were looking for.
Okay, so I'm assuming what he's saying is, I saw what happened. It freaked me the hell out. I've been in trouble before with the law, so I took off and started hiding because I didn't want to be involved.
Sure.
Which isn't a great alibi, honestly, but intriguing. But if they have evidence towards this, what is that evidence?
Well, he had more claims, so maybe we should start there.
Okay.
De Luna also claimed that the murderer was a known acquaintance of his. And he actually knew him. His name was Carlos, too.
Okay.
The term for this in Spanish is called a tocoyo, and that's how he referred to him. He went on to explain how this other tocoyo named Carlos Hernandez also looked exactly like him. A twin, or a doppelganger of sorts.
Now things are getting really weird.
It's kind of getting a little far out there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The defense team spent months trying to locate a Carlos Hernandez that fit De Luna's description, but they were unsuccessful. The Corpus Christi detectives and the Nueces County DA's office wouldn't have it either. They thought this claim was preposterous, and the charges stood, and they set a new trial date for the fall of 1983. During De Luna's trial, the prosecution based a huge part of their case on Kevin Baker and the other eyewitness statements to positively ID Carlos De Luna as the assailant, even though the crime scene was covered. Literally covered in evidence.
Do we know what that evidence was? Because it certainly doesn't sound like they did a whole lot of work towards recovering evidence at the scene.
you would be hitting the nail on the head, so to speak, with a lot of those things that you just said. It's the opinion of legal experts and James Liebman's research team that they felt the forensic evidence wouldn't hold up for some reason. Now, I will speak more to this in the next episode, and we'll get into exactly why. But one thing I can tell you is that when they arrested Carlos de Luna, he didn't have a speck of blood on him. And by speck, I mean they checked microscopically for blood evidence and found nothing. Not on his pants, under his fingernails, or even his shirt and shoes that were discovered the following day after his arrest.
Was this presented by the defense?
We're going to get into it in episode two as to what the full defense was for Carlos de Luna.
I am so confused. Yeah. Okay, I'm incredibly intrigued. I have so many questions.
Yeah. Well, they also pointed out that De Luna's checkered past was a big problem. See, he had a bunch of run-ins with the law as well.
Mm-hmm.
And De Luna was on probation for that public intoxication case at the casino club that I mentioned earlier. And he didn't tell his parole officer he was going out drinking. So that was a big mistake, too. He also had a couple assaults. He had a lot of drunken in public and disorderly conducts. He also had an attempted rape charge on his record for a few years earlier up in Garland, Texas. De Luna actually pled guilty to that attempted rape charge, and the prosecution made damn sure to highlight that for the jury.
Yeah, and then also he has admitted by his statements that he was there at the time of Wanda's attack, that he was outside the building. And that doesn't do him any favors as well.
Yep. And it starts to put him in different spots into a possible timeline that the prosecution can build against him.
Yeah.
So mainly what the prosecution used as far as evidence was several eyewitness statements, Kevin Baker's testimony in court, which he did go before and testify. And there's some intriguing things about his testimony that we'll get into later, and other circumstantial evidence to prove their case. Let's get into the defense a little bit. De Luna, he was desperate to prove his innocence to the jury, and his attorneys decided his best defense was to let him take the stand to tell his version of the events. That was pretty much their best strategic plan to get De Luna off, was to let him tell his full story of what happened.
That's interesting, because most defense teams, I don't believe, want their client to take the stand most times.
It's a roll of the dice. You only do that if you don't have another option, really. So De Luna did just that. He got up on the stand and he testified. He said that he spent the early evening with his two sisters, Marianne Perales and Linda Perales. A man named Carlos Hernandez approached them, and De Luna realized that they had known each other as children.
So he had never seen him in 20 years or whatever.
Yeah, however long it was.
So this night.
Yeah, so this is the night that they reunited from childhood, according to De Luna.
And he's, okay.
Which makes it even crazier, right?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds completely fabricated.
Yeah. De Luna said he was wearing a light blue shirt, black pants, and black slip-on shoes that night when they went out. De Luna and Hernandez ended up drinking together at Wolfie's Bar later that evening, until one point when Hernandez said he was going over to the Sigmore Shamrock to buy something. De Luna decided to finish his beer and wait at Wolfie's. After Hernandez did not return, De Luna began wondering why he was taking so long. De Luna testified that he approached the gas station and observed Hernandez attacking Lopez through the windows. Worried that people might say he was involved with Hernandez, just like you were saying, Aaron, De Luna started walking away in kind of a rush down the frontage road. When De Luna heard sirens, he started running. He also testified that his shirt had been ripped off while he was climbing over a fence in the nearby neighborhood. He told the jury that the bills in his pocket that were all wadded up were what was left of two of his recent paychecks. The similar amount to what the store register was missing was a coincidence, he supposed. The jury found the whole story of this phantom lookalike killer to be a really weak defense. One member of the media referred to it as, quote, ludicrous as a child's lie. Closing arguments soon came in this short trial, and then the jury was sent out to deliberate. Carlos de Luna was found guilty of the murder of Wanda Lopez after 4 hours of deliberations.
Wow, that's quick.
Yeah. They basically just went out to eat dinner and talked about it for a couple hours and then came back. He was sentenced to death by lethal injection. DeLuna would spend the next 6 years on death row, pleading for his innocence and speaking out about his tocoyo Carlos Hernandez's guilt to anyone who would listen. He gave several TV interviews and newspaper interviews.
And this whole time, this Carlos Hernandez cannot be found, right? Like, he's nowhere to be seen.
There's no sign of a Carlos Hernandez.
Okay, all right.
DeLuna's appeals came and went with no major change to his conviction. And as a result, Carlos DeLuna was put to death by lethal injection on December 7th, 1989. He commented in a TV interview just before his execution saying, quote, "Maybe one day the truth will come out. I'm hoping it will. If I end up getting executed for this, I don't think it's right," end quote. And that, my friends, is it. Just another robbery gone wrong. Wrong place, wrong time for Wanda Lopez. And, you know, tragedy befalling her family, that they have to get drugged through all this media attention and everything. It's awful, right? I mean, closed case. Right, Aaron?
Well, considering it's a two-parter, I feel like there's probably more.
Of course, that is not it. So as I mentioned before, in 2004, Columbia Law School professor James Liebman and 12 of his students began digging into Carlos DeLuna's case. They were building what would become his book called The Wrong Carlos. See, what James Liebman and his research students were doing originally was looking into the possibilities of false convictions in capital murder cases nationwide. They wanted to see if you could put together kind of an algorithm or some variables that happened in a lot of cases, like general mistakes, that could lead you to find the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, and then you would reveal, okay, this has some potential to be a wrongful conviction case. Somehow they ended up on Carlos DeLuna's file, and that's when everything changed. Almost immediately after scratching the surface and dusting off some old case files and evidence documents, the team knew they were onto something. Over the next 6 years, they interviewed over 100 witnesses, used 900 pieces of source material, and unearthed enough evidence to fill over 400 pages in a special publication to the Columbia Human Rights Law Review. I'll just say that publication typically is under 200 pages, and they doubled it just for this case. What did they find? Well, let's just say it's nothing short of staggering. A man named Carlos Hernandez not only existed, but he did look just like Carlos DeLuna. And I mean that. They could have been frickin' twins, Aaron. Like, there's a picture that you can see in the Guardian article that I sourced with multiple pictures of them kind of mixed up together, and you can't tell which one's which.
Okay.
It is wild.
So you're telling me that his story all along was true?
Yes, it seems that way. But, you know, keep in mind, DeLuna was no angel. This guy had an attempted rape charge. He was an alcoholic. He was not a great dude. But it did not compare to Carlos Hernandez's giant rap sheet. Hernandez was an alcoholic as well, but he had a history of terrible violence against women. He was connected to multiple cases of murder, rape, robbery, and deadly assault. In total, he was arrested 39 times. 13 of those had references to him having a folding buck knife when arrested.
Oh, wow.
Most of these cases didn't get Hernandez locked up in jail, though, but instead returned long parole sentences and expectations of good behavior for some reason. Liebman and his students dug through the crime scene evidence from the Shamrock gas station as well. They found some really glaring problems in their search. The blood spatter analysis, blood samples, fingerprints, even shoe impressions from the perpetrator had all been taken in as evidence. And on further inspection, they discovered that none of these pieces of evidence had been properly cared for or examined correctly or used to find the correct conclusions. Liebman postulates, if the detectives would have done these things, they would have easily deduced that DeLuna may have been telling the truth. Also, we'll take a look at who else knew about Carlos Hernandez's existence and why wasn't anything done about it. But for all this and more, my friends, you'll have to wait until next week for the conclusion of the second half of The Tale of Two Tocoyos. And believe me, we are going to pick over this case detail by detail, from the forensic evidence, the timeline, witness statements, new evidence, all of it. I have so many shocking details to go over with you. We haven't even scratched the surface, and I can't wait to get started. So stay tuned, y'all. We will be back. And now we're done for this week.
Wow. Well, this is absolutely fascinating. I have so many questions. I cannot wait to hear what your full analysis is next week. I'm actually very irritated that I have to wait, along with everyone else who is listening to this episode and very upset with you, Shay.
I know. I have to keep so much from you, and I'm in the same boat because I really want to talk to you about it, but I have to wait another week.
Ugh, yeah. Man, this is troubling on many, many levels.
It is, but hopefully we have something else coming up that is not troubling.
That is true. We have some amazing good news coming up. But lastly, we do want to thank Drew Margerison for sponsoring this topic. It was a very good topic that he chose. So thank you so much, Drew.
Yeah, thank you, Drew. He works on a ferry boat in Alaska.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yep.
Bet it's gorgeous. Hi, Drew.
Yeah, thanks for your support, bud.
All right, let's move on to good news. Hot on the heels of our Texas Rangers episode, we have a very sweet little story involving the Texas Rangers this week on Good News. And thank you to our Patreon Texas Ranger Michelle Guess for submitting this to our Facebook discussion group. So not only was she in the intro this week, but she also submitted this episode to us. So thank you so much, Michelle.
Yeah, she also met us at the meetup. So
that's right.
That's what you get for showing up and seeing our wonderful faces.
Pretty sure she's our best friend now.
Yeah.
I think that's how that works. Well, this story comes to us from KHOU Channel 11 News down in Houston, and it's about 6-year-old Abigail Arias. She was sworn in as an honorary Texas Ranger at the end of February. Abigail has been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, and her dream has always been to fight the bad guys in real life and in her lungs. In a unanimous vote in the House, Abigail was approved to become the newest Texas Ranger. She was given her own badge, her own official Texas Ranger hat, and as we learned episode, that was that big old white one that they wear.
That's right.
Documents stating that she is an official honorary Texas Ranger, and most importantly of all, hot pink cowboy boots emblazoned with an emblem of the Texas Rangers.
Oh man, that is awesome.
Yeah. She was given a special tour of the Capitol building in Austin, and she was able to swing the speaker's gavel, which she was also able to take home as a special memory.
Oh, man.
Special token of her time there.
I've always wanted to swing one of those gavels.
Oh, yeah. She was also able to make her first arrest, handcuffing Freeport Police Department Chief Ray Garavy, which is amazing. Chief Garavy was also the one to swear her in to her new role. The oath she took included the final line, "I now and forever promise to keep fighting the bad guys until all of my cancer is gone."
Oh my gosh, that is so touching.
It was so sweet. I highly recommend you to go watch some of those videos with little Texas Ranger Abigail Arias. She is absolutely adorable. You can tell she had so much fun on her special day. And from all of us at ACNC, congratulations to Abigail, and we wish her the best of luck.
Certainly, yeah. Get out there and get you some of them criminals.
That's right.
And fight that cancer.
Good job, Abigail. All right, guys, we got another podcast recommendation for you this week.
Oh, yes, we do.
And once again, it is another Parcast show because Parcast is killing it.
Their shows
are amazing. And this one is such a cool podcast. It's called Survival. And so it's basically like all of those amazing survivor stories that
I survived.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's in podcast form and it's such an interesting podcast. It grips you. You're like on the edge of your seat listening to these crazy, crazy stories about people in life and death situations and all of the strategies that they used in order to survive.
I am super stoked about it. I mean, some of them run the gamut between like people having to wade through snake infested water, like drinking their own urine, cutting off their own arms, stuff like that. I mean, it's just wild. And how these people were able to get through and make it to save their own lives is amazing.
Yeah. One of my favorite episodes was a story about this guy who escaped from a North Korean internment camp.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's just absolutely insane. There's also stories about people being trapped on sinking ships and everything that they have to do to like make it above water and then get away.
It's like having to swim through doors and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That is like my worst nightmare.
Yeah. So it's stuff that's so crazy, but it's also in a way positive because it's survivor stories. Like, people dealt with these horrible situations and they were able to live to tell the tale. And yeah. I think that's so fascinating. And you know, a lot of times with true crime, we don't get survivor stories because right. it's about victims who passed away. And so this is kind of like this, the same level of interest or intrigue that you get with true crime, except it's actual survivors who can really tell their tales.
Yeah. And it really goes to demonstrate the human spirit's ability to triumph over deadly adversity.
Yeah, I think so too. Be sure to check it out. It comes out Mondays. It's the Parcast Network's Survival. And here is their promo right here.
He was out for 3 days. This is a guy who should by all rights have been dead, but he survived.
How far would you go to save your own life?
Some say they had to be rescued by boat or wade through snake-infested water to get to dry land.
She rubbed her legs in the blood as she sat under a table so it would look like she was shot as well.
It was just very bad condition. I was using up my own body. I tried to drink urine.
On Parcast's new podcast, Survival, we look through the eyes of the world's most resilient survivors, people trapped on sinking ships, captured in death camps, alone in the Arctic wilderness.
We're with them every breath as their self-preservation instincts are pushed to the limit.
Within each weekly story, we'll analyze the strategies they use to survive and provide worst-case scenario advice for listeners. Then we see their return to normal life and how they adapt once again.
Once you've survived, you're always a survivor. But can you live with what you did to save yourself?
Survival premieres March 25th. It's a production of Cutler Media and part of the Parcast Network. New episodes release every Monday.
Survival. How far would you go to stay alive?
All right, guys, thank you for tuning in to the after show. And we wanted to speak really quickly about the meetup that happened in Fort Worth last weekend at the Yard. You guys, we had such a blast.
So much fun.
There were a lot of people who showed up. Every time that we've done a meetup, we've had more people come. And this time it was the biggest event that we've had yet. So we had a lot of listeners who came in. We were able to meet so many of you. A lot of our patrons came, and some of them were able to get the tumblers, the ones that won the tumblers for the March giveaway that we did. It was so fantastic. We got to meet so many people's dogs, which was exciting.
How many photos did we take with people?
A whole lot, yeah.
Yeah, so, it was wild.
Yeah, thank you so much to everybody who came out. We had such a blast. Nelson met, I think it was a bulldog named Finn.
Yeah, from
Nelson
Danny.
Loved. It was Danny's. One of our patrons, and Danny also gave us a cool book on Texas Monthly cases.
Oh, yeah.
That you're going to be sure to check out.
Man, I've been wanting that book for so long, and I was so honored that Danny gave us a copy of it. That was so cool.
Yeah. So it was so fun. I know that they're planning another meetup in Austin here in a couple months. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to make it to that, but I think right after that is going to be San Antonio. So if you weren't able to come out to the Fort Worth meetup, we still have other meetups in the future planned. And of course, we're going to be in Chicago in July.
Yes, you got to find us in Chicago if you're able to. That is going to be a blast. There's so many cool shows that are going to be there with us. It's going to be so cool.
And that's going to be the True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago, July 13th. Be there or be square. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, thank you to everybody who came, all of the listeners. Thank you to all the podcasts that showed up. It was really fun. Some of these people we met for the first time, and some of them we've known for, you know, since we started.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really incredible. Special thanks also to Serial Killer Sweets, who gave a huge box of free samples. We ate quite a lot of them ourselves before we even went there. They're so good. And another special thanks to Hoke Walker Originals, who did some amazing door prizes. Also made those tumblers for our group. Their products are incredible. And I know that she's going to be updating some information as to how people can go and purchase those things as well. Everybody, it was just really great. And thank you guys so much for coming out there. And I hope if you couldn't make it this time, you will try to make it out next time.
That's right.
And before we do our Patreon shout outs this week, we just wanted to give a little plug to some of our social media. So you can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast and on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. You can send us an email to allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And you can find our brand spanking new Facebook discussion group, which is going very well and is chill and super fun. And it's called the ACNC Posse Discussion Group.
Be sure when you do ask to join that you answer the questions.
Yeah,
that's a must.
Yes, mandatory.
Yeah. And also remember, if you want to call and leave us a message on our voicemail, maybe get on the show with a recording, call us at 682-200-9972.
Whew, okay, I feel like we've had so many announcements this week. Let's get to the good stuff. Let's give our patrons their shout out this month.
Yeah, that's right. It's the beginning of the month, so we gotta hit up our Texas Rangers first. You know the same group. They're all awesome. It's Lisa Layton. Serial Killer Sweets is now a Texas Ranger, so thank you. Michelle Guess, who you heard at the beginning of the show, and then Drew Margerison, who produced this episode, Kate Williams, Mel Thomas, Don Maloney. Thank you so much, Texas Rangers. You guys rock. Next up, we have our small town sheriffs, and that is Angela Walker of Hoke Walker Originals.
Woo-woo!
Elizabeth Campbell, Ashley Parker, Danny Jordan, Rebecca, Molly Smith, and Heather Nelson. Thank you, small town sheriffs. We can't do it without you. You're holding down the fort.
All right. Thank you guys so much for your support. We really do appreciate it, and it does help us out so much. And we will be doing the rest of the shout outs next week.
Then we'll do lone guns next week and then deputies the week after that. So if you too want extra bonus content, rewards, and shout outs on the show, find us at our Patreon site, patreon.com/allcrimenocattle. There's lots of cool stuff there.
Yeah, sure.
We got some sweet bumper stickers coming.
Oh, yeah, I'm excited. All right, guys, well, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really enjoyed it. I am very intrigued. I cannot wait to hear part two, and I hope you are too.
And have a good rest of your week, guys. We'll see you next week. But until then, always remember that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.